Today is February 27, 2019.
Here is some information for February 27th history. On the website on -this-day.com, they say, history for February 27th on -this-day.com. 1700, the Pacific Island of New Britain was discovered. 1801, the city of Washington, D.C., was placed under congressional jurisdiction. 1827, New Orleans held its first Mardi Gras celebration.
On February 27, 1844, the Dominican Republic gains independence from Haiti.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you just bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, call 641-793-7091. For those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comment to hank at pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission has successfully brought the first ever case against using fraudulent paid Amazon reviews to falsely advertise an online product. The FCC announced that the company in question, named Cure Encapsulations, Inc., they paid a third-party website to write five-star Amazon reviews for a weight loss supplement called Garcinia Cambogia. The plant native to Indonesia is widely mischaracterized as contributing to weight loss, but is in fact known to cause acute liver failure. Cure Encapsulations paid a website called AmazonVerifiedReviews.com. Cure Encapsulations use AmazonVerifiedReviews.com to keep the product's Amazon rating above 4.3 out of 5 stars, with reviews stating that the supplement worked as a powerful appetite suppressant and literally blocks fat from forming. The FTC found these claims to be false and unsubstantiated. People rely on reviews when they're shopping online. When a company buys fake reviews to inflate its Amazon ratings, it hurts both shoppers and companies that play by the rules. This is the first time the FTC has cracked down on a company buying fake Amazon reviews. Cure Encapsulations must now inform Amazon that it paid for reviews, itself a violation of Amazon rules around promotional content, and must also notify all customers who purchased the weight loss supplement. Fake Amazon reviews have been known as a problem for years, but regulators have shown little interest in cracking down on the practice until this recent suit. The FTC's latest action sets a firm precedent that the agency is willing to go after companies that abuse online products and platforms like this. It's not clear whether the agency has the resources to curb the behavior behind some of the biggest bad actors on sites like Amazon, but the settlement sends a message that companies like this can't rely on the trusted veneer of these marketplaces to excuse false advertising. The FTC has shown a growing interest in abusive practices in the tech industry in recent months, far beyond the low-level scams of fake Amazon reviews. Earlier, the FTC announced it would be forming a task force to monitor and take action against anti-competitive behavior in U.S. technology. The task force appears focused on increasingly centralized power of a few Silicon Valley giants like Google and Facebook. Major security issue found in popular password managers. A new report suggests that password managers aren't quite as secure as you might think, as they store the master password for the application in the PC's memory in a plain text form. Before you start to hit the panic button, let's clarify that the security researchers behind this report still advocate the use of these applications. The independent security evaluators, otherwise known as ISE, note that password managers are definitely a good thing. They help avoid many bad password practices like weak passwords or reusing passwords over and over and so forth. Bearing that in mind, ISE evaluated iPassword, Dashlane, KeePass, and LastPass on Windows 10 and found that the master password for the application was kept in the system memory in a plain text readable format. You need to enter the master password to access the many stored passwords inside the application. A hacker can potentially get in by sniffing out the plain text master password in the PC memory. And once they're in, they can access all the victim's user's name and passwords for every site and service they have signed on for. The security firm, using a proprietary reverse engineering tool, they were able to quickly evaluate the password manager's handling of secrets in its locked state. ISE found that standard memory forensics can be used to extract the master password and the secrets it's supposed to guard. Of course, we have to remember that the hacker still needs access first to your computer, either physically or, if remote, via some sort of backdoor installed by malware. The ISE further notes, it is evident that attempts are made to scrub and sanitize memory in all password managers which are evaluated. However, each password manager fails in implementing proper secrets sanitation for various reasons. Hopefully, the makers of these pieces of software are sitting up and taking notice and will have a plan of action to tackle the security flaws. Meantime, until patches are deployed to take care of these particular gremlins, the ISE recommends that you don't leave a password manager application running in the background, even in locked state, and that users should terminate the process completely if they are using one of the affected password managers. However, it's still worth noting that any hacker would need access first to your PC in some way to sniff out your password secrets. Verizon is asking the Federal Communications Commission to let it keep new smartphones locked to its network for 60 days as part of an initiative to prevent identity theft and fraud. After the 60-day period, the phones would unlock automatically. Verizon is just putting itself in line with the rest of the industry here. Verizon said it was going to put an unlocking plan into place that would better prevent against fraud. This temporary lock on new phones would protect customers by limiting the incentive for identity theft. AT&T already requires your phone be activated for 60 days for you to unlock it, and the company even requires you to wait 2 weeks to unlock your old phone. If you're upgrading to a new one, T-Mobile requires you to wait 40 days and also limits users to 2 unlocks per year per line. Sprint has a 50-day limit and only unlocks devices from the onset if the phones are prepaid. According to a report by the Wall Street Journal, several phone apps are sending sensitive user data, including health information, to Facebook without users' consent. An analytics tool called App Events allows app developers to record user activity and report it back to Facebook, even if the user isn't on Facebook. Facebook appeared to be accepting such data without telling the developers to stop. Developers are able to use such data to target their own users while on Facebook. One example given by the journal shows how a woman would track her period and ovulation using an app from Flow Health. After she enters when she last had her period, Facebook software in the app would send along data such as whether the user may be ovulating. Although Facebook's terms instruct app developers not to send such sensitive information, Facebook said in a statement that it requires apps to tell users what information is shared with Facebook, and it prohibits app developers from sending us sensitive data. The company said it works to remove information that developers should not have sent to Facebook. Criticism over privacy intensified nearly a year ago following the revelation that the now-defunct Cambridge Analytica data mining firm accessed data on some 87 million Facebook users without their consent. The United States Federal Trade Commission has been investigating that flap, as well as is reportedly in negotiations with Facebook over a multi-billion-dollar fine. The data sharing is related to a data analytics tool that Facebook offers developers. The tool lets developers see statistics about their users and target them with Facebook ads. Besides Flow Health, the journal found that Instant Heart Rate, HR Monitor, and real estate app Realtor.com were also sending app data to Facebook. The journal found that the apps did not provide users any way to stop the data sharing. Flow Health said in an email statement that using analytical systems is a common practice for all app developers, and that it uses Facebook Analytics for internal analytics purposes only. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo directed the state's Department of State and Department of Financial Services to immediately investigate what he calls a clear invasion of consumer privacy. He urged federal regulators to step in to end the practice. Samsung announced foldable smartphones. Unless you're crazy rich and have deep pockets, the foldable devices may not be for you. Samsung last Wednesday offered a longer, closer look at the Galaxy Fold, a smartphone that unfolds like a book, to reveal a second, larger display. It's the stuff of science fiction, and it opens the door to a whole new world of different designs and devices. The Galaxy Fold is not intended to be a mass-market item. It's a product aimed at early adopters and hardcore Samsung and gadget enthusiasts. For most customers, the Galaxy S10 line, alongside a Plus 5G and budget variants, will be more than sufficient for their needs. You think that $1,099 is a starting price for the iPhone XS Max is expensive? The Galaxy Fold will launch on April the 26th at a staggering $1,980. Woo! Samsung had said it had to rethink the software and user interface to take advantage of the two displays. The Galaxy Fold works well with Google Maps. The device will be able to run three apps at once, and seamless flow between the smaller device and the larger one works well in the demos. Google said it will support foldable devices with its next Android update, but that won't come until the second half of the year. For now, Samsung touted Google Maps and video from Netflix as examples of apps that will take advantage of the larger screens. The demand of not one, but two displays, including a massive folding one, will put a great demand on the battery. Samsung seems to know this, and it's touted with the inclusion of two separate batteries running the device. The downside of a foldable phone is, well, it folds. Two halves means a device that's going to be thicker than even the bulkiest of today's current smartphones. That comes at a time when phone makers are shaving millimeters off their devices and talking about sleek designs. The Galaxy Fold appears to be easily twice as thick as your standard phone, so just wait till you try to stuff it in the side pocket of your jeans. Durability is an unknown factor at this time. Samsung touted the proprietary articulate spine, as well as the coating on the glass that protects the foldable part from wear and tear damage, but even if Samsung has tested these phones, it's unclear just how durable they are. Also, good luck dealing with the device if you scratch or crack the screen. You're not going to be able to bring this into a screen repair shop to get it fixed. The Galaxy Fold has a massive 7.3-inch display. If you're the type of person who needs to have the latest and greatest, no matter what that price is, well, Price is not part of the discussion for you. Concerns like price and battery life probably aren't too critical since this isn't likely your only phone. It will become the latest status symbol. So, to those early adopters willing to brave the new world of foldable phones, eventually leading to more polished products for the rest of us, I salute you. But for now, I'll stick to my boring rectangular slab of glass and metal. Wow, $1,980. I thought price of electronics was coming down. Well, Facebook will shut down its spyware VPN application, Onavo. What is a VPN app to begin with? VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. A VPN can carry data in a secure private tunnel across the public internet. A VPN's purpose is providing a secure and reliable private connection between computer networks over an existing public network. Facebook acquired the VPN application Onavo in 2013, and they redefined the purpose of what a VPN is. Well, Facebook will shut down its spyware VPN app Onavo and take it off the Google Play Store. This followed TechCrunch's investigation about Onavo's code being used to gather up data about teens. The Onavo Protect application will eventually shut down and will immediately cease pulling in data for market research, though it will continue operating as a virtual private network in the short term to allow users to find a replacement. Facebook is very careful how they crafted the press release. This just means they have taken down the tool, but those who have the application will continue its use. Facebook has also ceased to recruit new users, but the Android existing Facebook research app studies will continue to run. This does not mean they will no longer take the data that is collected. With tech giants and looming regulation leading to more intense scrutiny of privacy practices, Facebook has decided that giving users a utility like a VPN in exchange for quietly examining their app usage and mobile browsing data isn't a wise strategy. Onavo billed itself as a way to limit apps from using background data and use a secure VPN network for your personal info, but also noted that it would collect the time you use the application, mobile and Wi-Fi data that you use per the application, and the websites you visited, and your country, device, and network type. Facebook provided this statement, "Market research helps companies build better products for people." Yeah, by spying on you. We are shifting our focus to reward-based market research, which means we're going to end the Onavo program. Facebook acquired Onavo in 2013 to use its VPN application to gather data about what people were doing on their phones. That data revealed WhatsApp was sending over twice as many messages per day as Messenger, which Facebook justified to pay a steep sum price of $19 billion to buy WhatsApp. Facebook went on to frame Onavo as a way for users to reduce their data usage, block dangerous websites, keep their traffic safe from snooping, while Facebook itself was analyzing that data. The insights helped it to discover new trends in mobile usage, keep an eye on competitors, and figure out what features or apps to copy, which resulted in Facebook's product strategy to develop Instagram's version of Snapchat stories. Facebook ran the program in secret, obscured by beta testing services like BetaBound and Applause. It only informed users it recruited with ads on Instagram, Snapchat, and elsewhere that they were joining a Facebook research program after they began sign up and sign non-disclosure agreements. A Facebook spokesman claimed in a statement that there was nothing secret about this, yet it had threatened legal action if users publicly disclosed the research program. But the biggest problem for Facebook ended up being that its research app abuse Apple's Enterprise Certificate program meant for employee-only apps to distribute the app outside the company. That led Apple to ban the research app from iOS and invalidate Facebook's certification. Check, check. certificate. This shut down Facebook's internal iOS collaboration tools. Without Anavo, Facebook loses a powerful method of market research. Hopefully, Facebook will be less secretive with its future market research programs. It should be upfront about its involvement, make certain that users understand what data they're giving up, stop researching teens, or at the very least, verify the consent of their parents and avoid slurping up sensitive information or data about a user's unwitting friends. For a company that depends on people to trust it with their content, it has a long way to go to win back our confidence. Questions from the listeners. Listener RS sent the following. Windows Defender blocked a new version of System Mechanic Pro on one of my Windows 10 machines. I had to turn off Windows Defender to use System Mechanic Pro. The System Mechanic Pro is a multifunction application, and it was primarily used by many to clean up a system, but the Pro version has the added antivirus protection. And you don't install two antivirus programs into the same machine. Microsoft has published the following. You should never run more than one antivirus at the same time. The two programs could slow down your computer, and they might even identify each other as a virus, which could lead to file corruption or other conflicts and errors that make your antivirus protection less effective or not effective at all. So uninstall the System Mechanic Pro and get yourself the lower cost System Mechanic without the antivirus protection. Listener XR had the following problems. Windows 10 password not accepted. Password not accepted with Gmail account. Password not accepted with cell phone. The listener had numerous problems, and this was just what I was able to extract from what he described. Windows 10 password not accepted. Well, use another system and download the Trinity Rescue Kit. The Trinity Rescue Kit, or TRK, is a free live Linux distribution that aims specifically at recovery and repair operations on Windows machines, but it is also equally usable for Linux recovery issues. Install this utility on a flash drive. Change your setup boot to the USB flash drive and boot the program in place of the Windows boot. Trinity Rescue Kit can easily reset Windows passwords. When the system is back in your control, create another user account with administrator permission, then change your user account to non-administrator. This will prevent someone else being able to change your account password. Password not accepted with Gmail account. Choose the I don't know my password option and enter your email address. Click on Continue. If you linked a phone number to your Gmail account, you can request a verification code sent in a text message, or you can answer security questions under Verify Your Identity section. And his last part was password not accepted with Android cell phone. Unlock the phone with your Gmail account. Click on Forgot Pattern at the bottom of the lock screen. Enter your Google account username and password, click Sign In, choose a new password, and unlock your device. Listener PK has the following question. I'm interested in purchasing a Lenovo E590, and there are two configurations. The configurations are identical, but there's one model with the Intel Core i3 processor, and for $10 more, there is the identical model with the Intel Core i5 processor. The former unit is equipped with the i3 CPU and can be customized, whereas the latter unit with the i5 CPU is a fixed configuration. What do you recommend? With laptop systems, a hard disk drive can easily be replaced with a solid-state drive. Memory can be upgraded to maximum capacity. The CPU, however, is soldered and cannot be upgraded. The units are essentially the same price. The i3 CPU system can be upgraded by Lenovo, but you'll have to customize the i5 CPU unit separately. My recommendation? Buy the i5 CPU unit, as the processor cannot be upgraded. If you have questions, send it to hank@pcradioshow.org. Benjamin, let's tell the good listeners out there why backup is so important and how you go about doing it, and perhaps we can persuade those that haven't done it yet or haven't gotten started to, well, they should start doing it. Benjamin, take it away.
Technology in the workplace is all around us. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to put on my work hat, and I'm going to talk about those things that you hear at the office, but you want to know a little bit more information about it. Today, I'm addressing the world of the IT professional and how they work with backups. First, before I go any further, do you do backups? The backup of your data, of our systems, is important beyond most people's comprehension until they've lost something that they simply cannot replace on their computer. A long time ago, I was working on a team. We got a new guy. He came on board, and he talked a really good game. But we started to really wonder about him. I don't know. We were confused. He didn't seem to respond to computer conversations like other team members. And it puzzled us until one day, about 3 weeks later, this particular team member was assigned to back up the servers, and he went off to do his job. Many hours later, computer users were freaking out. They were calling about their files going missing. And after some research, we found out that in setting up the backup, that team member had checked a crucial box that said, back up the files, then delete them. Yep, that's right. That's just like the tape on Mission Impossible. Good luck, Jim. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds. What? Wait a second. In the personal world, that would be a disaster. Okay, actually, in the professional world, it's a near disaster as well. We had roughly 300 people that were without access to their data for over a day. Yes, that takes a while to recover. That's 300 people that lost a work day. I'll let you do the math. It's a lot. Fortunately, there are a number of things that we do as technology professionals to back up the data that is so near and dear to our company, that keeps the company afloat, that without it, well, unemployment and job classified sections would be the near future for many of our coworkers. First, there are multiple backup systems available. In this case, we only had to pull the tape that was just created. We just started running the restore process. Now, sure, there would be a few files that were updated that day that would be gone, but a day's lost work is better than losing all of the data. Next, there are options like multiple tapes, and there are extensive strategies for this. Now, one such strategy is to back up the systems completely once a week. Now, you then do a backup every night of all of the files that have changed since the last backup of those files. You then keep each of those daily backups for the entire week, and then combined with a weekly backup, you've got everything for the week. At any point in time, you can go back and just restore anything. You then keep that one weekly backup from the end or the beginning of the month. So now you have a monthly backup, a weekly backup for everything that month, and then the daily backups as well. Stack one more on there, and you keep one backup each year, usually coinciding with your fiscal year. You then reuse any of those tapes when that particular individual backup is no longer needed. That would be all of them except for the annual backup. So ideally, you always have the January 1st of every year, the 1st of every month, the 1st of every week, and one for every day this week. That's a lot of tapes. But there's other options too. One option is a special server that works as a disaster recovery box. What does this do? Well, it keeps all of the data, much like on tapes, but on very special hard drive setups that track and deduplicate the data. Deduplicate, tricky term. It's kind of what it sounds like. It goes through and it makes sure it's not storing a bunch of the same information over and over and over and over and over again. So in that way, we're compressing it. Now, these hard drive setups compress it even more. It then stores the data in multiple ways So it would take a complete, total, end-of-the-world-style disaster to lose important data. The cloud, the internet, is also one that is out there and is in use by a number of companies. And all of the data in some companies is already completely, fully stored in the cloud. There is a major shifting of responsibility from the local IT guy to places like Amazon or other remote data locations. But fortunately, Amazon and those many companies that handle those remote data locations, they also know the importance of saving data. They keep huge warehouses full of servers that are loaded up with a whole bunch of hard drives, and they set up special systems to keep your data secure. Now, it does mean moving a lot of data over the internet, but now, I'm going to go back to the very beginning. I asked you this question at the very beginning, but I'm going to preach it to you one more time. When was your last backup? If the professionals can keep track of backups like this, what are you doing to keep your data, your information, your livelihood, your tax returns, your camera photos, your resume, your business, the many portions of your life? What are you doing to keep it secure? All of those things I've mentioned, those important parts, those pieces of your life are all on your local hard drive. And in a moment, they can be gone, just poof, forever erased. You need to go out, get a backup hard drive, back up all of your data. Don't risk it. I know so many people who have just said, oh, I'll deal with it later. I did that once. I said, I'll deal with it later. And I really was only going to wait a couple of weeks. It just so happened that, yeah, I lost data too. Oh, well. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Chromebook 101. What is a Chromebook? A Chromebook is a laptop of a different breed. Instead of Windows 10 or Mac OS or a version of Linux, Chromebooks run Google's Chrome OS. These machines are designed to be used primarily while connected to the internet, with most applications and documents living in the cloud. You can think of a Chromebook as an internet-dependent laptop that boots up in a fraction of the time it takes to start up when compared to systems installed with other operating systems. When you turn on the Chromebook, you'll notice the only native app is the Google Chrome Internet Browser, and that's pretty much your key to all that is that what a Chromebook is. Everything else is composed of web apps. Things like email, photo, documents, or apps that run while you're connected to a network. Google also throws in 100 gigabytes of cloud storage for every Chromebook. The obvious benefit is everything being saved on the web is that you'll have access to it from any other computer. If your Chromebook ever crashes, you won't have to worry about losing all your apps, documents, and settings. It is very easy to quickly restore the Chromebook to initial factory condition, and since your apps and data is online, you'll be able to get operational very quickly. The downside is when the online access is not available. Chromebooks connect to the internet, but there are times when you simply can't find a Wi-Fi signal. Fortunately, there are workarounds for plenty of routine tasks. You can still compose and read emails with Gmail offline, and word process with Google Drive offline. The offline apps will automatically sync and save when your data has an internet connection. These are some of the tasks that Chrome OS can manage without internet connection. Check calendar for appointments. Write emails with Gmail offline. Create and edit documents with Google Drive. Listen to music, which has been stored on Chromebook's internal storage. Note-taking with Google Keep, and save web pages for offline reading. Gaming, however, is not really Chromebook's thing due to Chromebook's small storage and relatively weaker specs. Chromebooks have long battery life. It's not uncommon to find a Chromebook that can last all day on one charge. There are times when Chromebook cannot access the internet. Examples are anyone who depends on Photoshop or other downloadable software. The web-based equivalents like Pixar aren't really viable alternatives. Along the same lines, most Chromebooks have a lower screen resolution. That may not be a huge factor when checking email and using Drive, but you'll notice it when you try to run more advanced applications. Printing and Bluetooth pairing is also a headache on Chromebooks. Google's native Cloud Print isn't really up to par, and Bluetooth pairing is inconsistent. Chromebooks may not be a powerhouse, but they'll tackle basic internet tasks like the best of them. Chromebooks excel where the needs are internet access and the use of basic office functions are online. So what is there to like and what is there to dislike? Well, let's say you buy a Chromebook and it's brand new. They come with virus protection built in and they update automatically. That's good. In the Chromebook, you're protected by multiple layers of security to defend against malware, viruses, and accidental mishaps. Google Chrome uses a process called sandboxing so that every tab you open is isolated from the important functions of your Chromebook. That means that even if your tab lands on a page that is infected by malware, it can't attack the rest of the computer. In the rare cases where something does go wrong, a fresh start is just a click away with a power washing feature on your Chromebook. You can easily refresh your device back to factory settings and get rid of any malware in the process. Your Chromebook automatically updates its software in the background, so you always have the latest and greatest security updates. Every Chromebook comes with a 10-hour battery life, so you can do more with every charge. That's 10 hours to work, play, watch, and make completely cord-free on this all-day battery. Chromebooks boot in seconds and updates automatically, so they're always working at peak performance. No long load times, no confusing setup, just flip it open and just get it going. So what is there to not like? Well, when you buy a brand new system, it starts up in guest mode. It is in limited run mode, and you need to log on each time, and that is not a recommended option because it's very limited processing. To run in normal mode, you will need to have an email account to start up a new Chromebook. I tried it with an AOL email account, and it was rejected. It must be a Gmail account. That is not a big deal because there is no charge to open a new Gmail account. So what's the big deal? Well, to create a Gmail account, you need to copy the 6-number code to confirm the password of the created account. And how is that 6-number code sent to you? As a text message, which means you need to be able to enter a 6-digit number which was sent to your telephone as a text message. Hey, if you only have a landline, there is no text message capability with a standard landline. So use your cell phone. Well, not everyone has a cell phone. Those that opted to have a low-cost cheap phone doesn't have text messaging capability. You need to have a buddy then with a cell phone to assist. You will also need this capability each time you add something from the Google Store. For most people, getting on the internet, browsing on your email, well, that's all most people do, but there are others that use it for tax preparation. You can do tax preparation online, and if you're sensitive to having your private information online and left up there, well, then you don't have a tax preparation capability on the Chromebook. So to recap, which means that if you can use and accept the Office functions that is online with Google Docs, and if you only want to do browsing on the internet without doing any transaction processing, well, this might be the machine you've been looking for.
Mardi Gras is next Tuesday, March the 5th. It's Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, Shrove Tuesday, Pancake Tuesday, with parades and parties and beads and amazing food, and a big fling before Lent begins. Those of us who don't go to New Orleans
to join the fun may want to enjoy our reverie at home, and Marty has some ideas about how our homes can help with that. Marty, let's hear from you.
Mardi Gras, the big Marty party. And no, I'm not throwing it. Whether or not you plan on hosting something festive for Fat Tuesday, there will be a time when you want to entertain at home. So we should take a little time to entertain a few ideas about how you can get your home tweaked to help that. So what's different about your house during those times when you're entertaining guests? If it's just another couple, well, that's entertaining, even if it's not revelry. But there's not much difference at all. It's a lot like when you're just there alone. On the other hand, what's different when you have, oh, maybe 10 or 20 or 30 guests? Well, the kitchen is almost certainly more active. Things cooking or heating or being reheated or being kept warm. Even without extra people indoors, like in the summer when everyone gathers outside. You remember summers, don't you? Anyway, whatever is getting warmed will add to the amount of heat that the kitchen's creating. And somehow or another, the house will have to compensate for that. But what if it's not summer? What's the impact, then, of 10 or 20 or 30 more people in the house? Remember, that's 10 or 20 or 30 times 98.6 degrees of body heat. I remember reading that the human head, the head alone, radiates about the same amount of heat as an old-fashioned incandescent bulb. And you may be old enough to remember that it only took one incandescent bulb to do all the cooking in a Kenner Easy Bake Oven. If it's easier to imagine 10 or 20 or 30 old light bulbs heating up the room, that's fine. Or just think about 10 or 20 or 30 places where the immediate ambient temperature is 98.6 degrees. Yes, the point is that those people are a pack of heat that your house doesn't usually encounter. Is there anything you can do to help your house adjust to that? More ice in the drinks isn't the answer. Start with this. About 15 minutes before the first guest arrives, set the thermostat to 1 degree lower, maybe 2. During the heating season, figure that your guests will make up the difference, and in any case, their heat won't combine as much with the furnace heat. In the cooling season, meaning air conditioning season, again, set the temperature on the thermostat 1 or maybe 2 degrees lower, so when all that radiant body heat warms things up, it all balances out to a temperature that everybody finds comfortable. There's an assumption in that. It assumes that your guests tend not to be very close to the thermostat. If your layout is such that you'll always find a couple of guests within 2 to 3 feet of the thermostat, then you don't have to adjust it at all. It will already know about their heat and bring your space to a happy place. In any case, if it isn't too loud, switch your ventilation system fan from auto to on. That will let it help keep air moving and circulating, which helps keep all that body heat that's being generated in one place from staying collected in one place. Is there a ceiling fan? Put it on its slowest setting and adjust the direction so that it moves air upward toward the ceiling. The goal is not to create a breeze, but to simply stir the air. Remember, all the people are closer to the floor, and all that heat rises toward the ceiling. If you tried moving air along the floor, all those people would disrupt the airflow, but the air has a free and open path along the ceiling, so blow the air up. During the heating season, if you have a lot more people coming to your soiree, you might consider going to the farthest rooms, maybe upstairs if you have a second story, and opening the windows there by an inch. Do you expect any guests who haven't given up smoking yet? Provide an outdoor area with ashtrays, lighting, and in the winter, some form of heat. Consider renting one of those propane mushroom head things. The more you keep that smoke out of the house, the less you'll have to do to expunge its remnants after the party. If someone in your family smokes, consider a more than light duty ionic air cleaner in a room that you can isolate. Don't count on any air cleaner with filters to remove those smoke remnants, and consider putting purpose-built filters into the cold air returns. Now, clear the smoke from your thinking, and let's see if there's something here that might be useful even if you never throw parties. Remember, one of the main reasons we're going into all this is to get you some payback from your house in terms of things like reduced energy bills and delayed needs for expensive repairs or replacements through measures you undertake to make things better. The things we found to deal with in the party context were infrequent sources of heat from the kitchen and from the body heat of a large number of guests. And what might you expect to be the effects of my suggestion? One is that it spreads the heat around to reduce its impact on the party rooms. It does that with things that are already there, like the HVAC system fan and the ceiling fan, if there's one in the room. And if it can't be quite effective enough with just that, we talked about very minimal adjustments to the thermostat to offset the temperature it sees as a way to better cope with the temperature gains we expect in the room. You know, I've looked at dozens of smart thermostats and so far haven't seen one with a party mode. That might be something they should consider. We also said that in extreme circumstances, it might make sense to open a distant room's windows by maybe an inch. That's the opposite of our usual advice about sealing the envelope of a house for complete containment so it doesn't lose heat. There's no contradiction in this. When the house has to deal with excess heat, a little controlled unsealing of the envelope can balance that temporary heat gain by allowing a little deliberate heat loss to help keep things comfortable. One thing we didn't mention. Spend a few bucks on those little plug-in carbon monoxide alarms. With all those people and all that cooking and maybe some warming trays and maybe some candles, there may be a little more carbon monoxide than usual. If you see people getting drowsy, that may be the cause. And they may never wake up, or you either. So spend a few bucks on an ounce of prevention. And if it sounds off, open all the windows and doors, get everybody outside, and the heck with the energy efficiency of that night, call the fire department and tell them your CO detector went off. Even if that doesn't happen, the indoors will still be at a little lower oxygen level than usual and a little higher carbon dioxide level than usual. Keep an eye out, again, for drowsiness. Too much carbon dioxide indoors is a recoverable condition, but that's a drowsiness that coffee can't counteract. Just stay alert to it. Next time, we'll just be a few days ahead of the beginning of daylight savings time. That's a shift that happens twice a year, and there are things you should be doing twice a year other than just resetting your clocks. Things like replacing the smoke detector batteries and seeing the dentist, but that's far from all. I'll share some other things you can do to pocket some payback on the house.
Thank you, Marty. TCF, which stands for the Trenton Computer Festival, is Saturday, March the 23rd, 2019, and it's a one-day event from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. It is held at the College of New Jersey campus in Ewing Township, covering computing and electronic technology. For more information, visit the website tcf-nj.org. That's tcf-nj.org. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. These computer club meetings are free to attend and open to the public. The Brookdale Computer User Group has a presentation on how to avoid internet and telephone computer scams. Thursday, February 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m. in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, March the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m. and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, March the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they do have a new location that they meet at now. It's the Danbury Hackerspace, located at 158 Main Street, Danbury, Connecticut. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, March the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the Harry J. Schurhoff New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, out in Old Westbury, New York. The Westchester PC Users Group meet Thursday, March the 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, March the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, March the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And they meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, the Silver Building. And that's located in Manhattan, New York. Photo ID is required. Princeton PC Users Group has a presentation on Cut the Cord, Thursday, March the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember to back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.